Penta. 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 Penta, 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 penta.
I got bras of Wakanda. My niggas, they call me T'Challa. Keep my claws looking polished. My brainium lit if I'm honest. Legacy, Panther. She getting the green like I'm Banner. That's why I'm the king of commander. A beast if I'm keeping the candy. Legacy, Panther. Control if you think you can handle. It's the reason I'm keeping the man. So you wanna step to me, you could be canceled. Due to your crew like I do in one panel. One hit to your chest and you blue like a candle. I left when I tied to my shoes and my sandals. I come after anyone, you can ask status. Easily.
Welcome to a special delivery episode of Wakanda Forever. I'm your host, Scarus. With me is my guest host, Kaz. That's your intro.
Cash Bell. How's it going, everybody?
Yo, and today we don't have Tiffany today. Tiffany is on a brief hiatus. She's in between things, so for an episode or two, she won't be around, but she will be coming back. So I know y'all, you guys are going to miss her, but going into this episode, we're doing a special delivery, and of course, as always, we're in the Quinjet, and we had a special guest, which is one of the writers that I think is putting some of the hardest work in the industry right now. I mean, shoot, I can't even name all the works. I mean, we got like Romulus, Michael Cray, we got Postal, Cyberforce, we got Evil Dead. We got, I believe it's Aphrodite 5 coming out, or V. I'm not sure on that pronouncement. Plus Detective Comics. Man, look, this man is busy. He's putting in work. We got Mr. Brian Edward Hill.
Hey, what's up, everybody? How's everybody doing?
So,
doing pretty dandy, man.
We're doing great, man. We're glad to have you. Man, I don't know how you do so much writing at the same time.
Well, man, let me tell you. So, I don't really socialize, right? Yeah. So that's a big part of it. Like, I don't really go out, you know, like I pretty much just, I write my stuff. And then whenever I'm out doing something, I'm probably making something, you know, I don't really just go to a bar and do all that. Like, this is not how my lifestyle goes. So when you don't, you know, waste time, and I really try not to, you know, you have a little bit of time. You can work on some things. And so most of the time that I spend as my free time, I just do that to recharge. I play a video game, read a book, you know, work on some music stuff, whatever I want to do. But cutting out that, you know, the kind of waste of time out of the schedule, you know, it opens up a lot of space to get a lot of stuff done.
Yeah, man, because I'm like, wow. It almost seems like every week it's like I see another thing, I'm like, oh man, he's putting in the work, man. He's gone. And you know, we spoke before about Romulus. That was my man. When that first came out, I don't know what it was. I didn't even know what it was. I just saw it on the shelf and I was like, huh, that looks interesting. And I copped it and I read the first issue and I was like, oh, this is dope. So I had to hit you up when I read that, and yeah, man, that was some great stuff. But then, like, I see Michael Cray and Postal. So before we get into the books or anything like writing wise and stuff like that. What's up with like growing up wise? Like what kind of stuff were you into? What were some of the nerdy things that you were into, or fandoms, or even non-nerdy things? Like what kind of stuff were you into growing up?
Well, you know, I've always had a very, loose connection with reality, fellas. Mm-hmm. So when I was growing up, I didn't know what I really wanted to do. You know, I was growing up watching the same movies we all watched, Indiana Jones and the Batman and the James Bond and the rest of it. And I wanted to have an uncommon life.
Right.
You know, I didn't know what that was going to mean. Like, how do you travel that path? I didn't really have a plan. But I was like, oh, yeah, I want a little more. I mean, I was growing up in St. Louis, Missouri, where everything is kind of charted out for you. You know, you go to school and then you go to more school and then you get a job at the cubicle, and then you work the cubicle, and then you make little versions of yourself that cost a bunch of money, and then you put them in the school, rinse and repeat.
Oh, my God.
That's life.
That just didn't seem, you know, like the move for Young Hill. So I didn't really know what I wanted to do career-wise until maybe later on in high school. You know, and I was deep into comics. I was, you know, a huge fan of Batman. That was probably the character I followed the most. But, you know, I like Superman a lot, Spider-Man. You know, I grew up on all that McFarlane stuff. So that stuff was a big part of it.
Oh, I love McFarlane.
And I honestly thought for a while I was going to go to the FBI and I wanted to catch serial killers.
Oh,
okay.
I was really into Thomas Harris, the author, when I was in high school, and he wrote this book, Red Dragon. And so I read Red Dragon when I was like a freshman or something. And I was like, this is what I want to do. You know, I want to get into the minds of the killers and see what they see and take them, you know, off of the fields, so the world's a safer place. I had this whole thing. Mm-hmm. And then I told my mother about it. My mom's like, pick something else. And I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, you're not doing anything where you have either a badge or a gun or both. Pick something else.
Right.
And I'm like, well, I like movies. So I guess I'll try to make movies. So then I went to film school. Yeah. I had a scholarship kid and I went to NYU. And I was the brokest kid in NYU. Like, I am convinced I was the brokest kid in NYU. Like, senior year, tuition just took so much out of everything that I couldn't live in the dorms. I was living up in, kind of north of Harlem, 138 in St. Nicholas Terrace. And it's a little more gentrified now than it was when I was there. When I was there, it was a little real when I was there. It's not quite as stark as it was back then. But yeah, I mean, that was, you know, kind of it sort of exemplified, you know, my kind of scholastic experience. Like, I was always a scholarship kid around people that had a lot more money and resources than I did. But I was just trying to make my way through it. I mean, I used to walk from 138 all the way down to A Street where campus was because I was too broke to ride the train.
Jeez. Yeah, that's a long
way.
I would get up at like 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. And I would just start walking, and I would get down there, you know, probably around 8:30. Class started at 9, and I would just go to my class. And I worked on a bunch of people's student films because they would feed you when you worked on a student film. So I was like, all right, I'll work on everybody's movie because they'll have pizza, and pizza will keep me from being hungry.
Right.
So that was the hustle that I had going on, and at the time, it was, you know, it's funny. It was rough at the time, but also when you hit that crazy mind state where you're just like, nothing's going to stop me from doing what I want to do. I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to figure it out. And a part of that's also growing up with the stuff that I grew up reading. Like, mm-hmm. you know, anytime I get in a jam, anytime I don't know a way through or some adversity shows up, I literally sit back and think, what would Bruce Wayne do?
Right.
And then I just figure it out. Right.
That's what he does. He figures out everything in the most ridiculous ways.
Bruce just figures it out. Yeah. And even if you don't have his resources and the rest of it, Bruce would still figure it out with what you have right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like if you went to Batman and you were like, Batman, I don't know how I'm going to do this problem. I can't solve it. I don't have the resources. And you're like, empty your pockets. And then he would show you what you could do with what's in your pockets, right? So, yeah, so, you know, comics for me were a way that I coped with the struggles of just growing up. And, you know, being a black kid in St. Louis, Missouri is not the easiest thing in the world.
Right.
And back then, the internet wasn't what it is now. So you didn't really have this global community where you could check in with people and see that other people were experiencing what you were experiencing. You were just in this difficult space, and a lot of times you just didn't understand why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what people don't get about things like prejudice and racism, and I think prejudice in a lot of ways is more dangerous than racism. When you say like racism, you think of this virulent, sanguine racist with a sign and a shaved head and a tiki torch.
Right. Exactly.
And that's That's out there, but that's not really the day-to-day. The day-to-day are all the people that just have different expectations for you,
mm-hmm.
you know, because of what they see.
Prejudice and is what's in a normal people's mind, everyday people.
And they treat you different, right. you know, and you don't recognize what's happening. There's just there's a pressure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just have this pressure that's on you all the time, you know, whether it's someone looking at you, you know, when you're in a store or just the having to say something two or three times before someone actually realizes you're speaking to them about something, you know, intellectual, like all those little things that you deal with. I just thought that was part and parcel of growing up. And then when I went to NYU, I realized like, oh, wait a minute. Maybe that was just St. Louis.
Right. Right.
You know, maybe that was just the place where I was from. So when I was a kid, you know, reading comics and looking at stories of heroes and studying mythology, all of that made sense to me because you always felt like you were in some kind of battle. And, you know, I'm sure for everyone, you know, they feel like that no matter what, you know, culture or place you come from. You know, I mean, everyone's always fighting a war to figure out who they are and carve a little space out for yourself. But for me, comics helped contextualize that.
Right.
You know, it helped me figure out, like, okay, how do I deal with adversity? And how do I forge myself into the kind of man that I want to be? And like Luke Skywalker, I was that kid looking at the two suns, wanting to be more than a moisture farmer.
Yeah, I feel that.
Try to get out to Tachi Station to get those power converters.
Try to get some power converters, man. Can we get some power converters off of this piece? So stories helped inform the most difficult moments in my life. So when I realized that, well, I'm not going to go catch serial killers, that's not going to happen. I got to figure something else out. I really wanted to tell stories because the older you get and the more things that you endure and survive, for me, the more you want to create the kinds of narratives that helped you,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You want to make the kind of work that helped you when you needed help and kind of keep that cycle going. And so that's where the idea of being a writer and a filmmaker kind of came from. I mean, I went to film school, but I didn't make a lot of films because film was too expensive. Mm-hmm. And it was about $1,000 a minute, yeah, to shoot a movie when I was in school. And they gave you like a little bit for free when you signed up for the course, but it wasn't enough to really make anything. I mean, you can only do like one or two takes and you can only make something like 3 or 4 minutes long. You get something in focus, somebody would walk across the room and then that was pretty much the end of your film.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized, well, you can't, Brian, you're not going to be able to make a lot of movies. Here, but you can write because writing is free. You know, you just need a legal pad and a Bic pen, and then you can write.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what, you know, turned me into thinking about just doing a lot of writing. You know, I didn't know as a filmmaker how you came out of film school and got a screenplay. I certainly wouldn't have the money to buy a screenplay from anyone or option a screenplay or any of that. I was going to have to generate it myself.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all necessity, really. And then I bummed around New York for a while, met a bunch of comic book artists, didn't really try to get into comics, didn't really know how one would get into comics. But, you know, I was talking to them and kind of getting a sense of what the industry was like. Same time, I was writing more screenplays, and then the first big breakthrough I had, it was a big breakthrough for me. You know, Hollywood wouldn't care about it, but I cared about it. I wrote a Dolph Lundgren movie about 2 or 3 years out of film school, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a major moment for me because I got flown out to Spain to meet with Dolph, and he and I talked about the script. He had an idea that he wanted me to write. So I talked to him about the idea, and I remember I checked into the hotel they put me in, and I walked over to the beach. Beach was about 2-3 minute walk away from the hotel, and you can see the Rock of Gibraltar sitting in the middle of the water. You know,
that's wild.
It was just sitting there. And I was eating like this Mediterranean meal or something, you know, served to me by the most beautiful woman I had ever seen by that point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And see, I'm sitting there eating this spiced chicken, looking at the Rock of Gibraltar, and I'm thinking to myself, if my 12-year-old self would have known that this would happen, then I probably would have been a lot more chill.
Right. Yeah, no doubt.
You know, and so that you know, drawing a little bit of blood kind of helped me, you know, keep my feet up under me in the ring. And then I just kept you know, trying to write screenplays, and then I sold a couple, and that brought me out to LA, and my first comic book thing was all through Taka. Nelson Blake II, the artist of Romulus, he introduced me to a guy named Rob Levin, who's now editing Michael Cray.
Right.
And Rob at that time was working at Top Cow with Matt Hawkins, and Philip Sablik was over there at the time before Philip went to Boom. And, you know, I just kind of said, hey, I'd be interested in writing a thing over here, over here, over here, and wasn't really getting a lot of attention, mainly because it's hard to get people to read things.
What time frame was that? Like what? Was that 2000s, 90s?
Oh, man. It's got to be, I guess we're talking like, 05 around there?
Yeah.
Because the first thing I did was a short story in a Witchblade trade paperback, and Ron Mars gave me like 6 pages in that trade paperback. And Ron was kind of a mentor to me. You know, he was the first comic book professional to really kind of open himself up and teach me format and just teach me how the business worked and, you know, how you could sort of build a career step by step. So, you know, I always credit Ron for getting me, kind of going in this. I call him Obi-Wan. And, so he gave me that short story and I, you know, had that in there. And, well, no one really cares about it, the short story and the thing or whatever. But, you know, again, I was able to walk into a comic book store and find the work that I did in there. And that meant everything. You know, that, just showed you again, like, okay, you can do this. Mm-hmm. You know, because if you can accomplish a small thing, then all you have to do to get the big thing is accomplish a bunch of small things. Right? Exactly. The most important thing is the small thing. I tell people that all the time. Like, don't worry about the big sale or the big hit or whatever it is. That's all going to take care of itself. Just get the small thing. You know, it's like football. Don't worry about the touchdown. Keep getting first downs and the touchdown takes care of itself.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that, you know, kind of, you know, said, hey, I really want to do this one, dedicate myself. And then a couple more things with Top Cow. I did a one shot with Rob Levin. We co-wrote this. It's called 7 Days from Hell. And Phil Noto did the art, which is awesome. I have this Phil Noto book, you know, back in my history somewhere, and it's gorgeous. And, that, you know, that got things going a little bit. And then screenwriting picked up, and I did a couple projects. And at this point, I have a little money in the bank. So, I'm able to kind of make some more of my own choices. And I was over in Thailand working on an animated feature. I wrote an animated movie called Nine Satra, The Legend of Muay Thai. And I think it opened about 4 or 5 months ago in Thailand. And from what I understand, it's doing very well. I haven't been over there since the movie opened, but I still talk to the producers and they're very happy with how it's all going. So I think it'll be over in America at some point on Amazon, Netflix, what have you.
Yeah, I'm excited to check that out.
It's cool. It's cool. I mean, if you look up Nine Satra, S-A-T-R-A, Nine Satra, The Legend of Muay Thai, then, you know, the trailer will come up, and I don't think it's in English, but it's cool. It's got this CGI, but it has kind of anime feel, and it's sort of neat. So I was in Thailand working on that, and Matt Hawkins, and I, Top Cow's president over there, you know, we would just talk back and forth. And a lot of how I got work out of people wasn't really pitching a bunch of things. It was more just like having conversations and just kind of being around and just letting things happen organically. Like, you know, I mean, I tried the whole like kind of hanging around the table and no one's going to talk to you with the script in your hand thing. And that didn't work out.
Right.
But, what seemed to work out was just kind of projecting an aura of, you know, competence.
Right.
And building up relationships and all that. And, you know, I tell people that the best thing to do is to be the easiest person for someone to call in their Rolodex. Right. If you can turn yourself into the easiest person to call, then you're probably going to get some work. You know, if you can turn yourself into a problem solver, then you're probably going to get some work. So I reached out to Matt and I said, hey man, I'm interested in doing some comics. I need to get something published. I need to get back into this comic book thing. You know, what do you have over there? And he said, let's have coffee and we'll talk about it. So we went out and we had coffee. And he brought up this idea of Postal. It's like, I had the story that I'm kind of working on, and here's the concept and the character and the mailman. And, you know, he's diagnosed with Asperger's, but he's also like kind of a town detective. Mm-hmm. So I went home and I did like a 2-page kind of thought process about what I saw, you know, when he was telling me the story.
Right.
And in my mind, I it felt like it had shades of Truman Capote, you know, it had shades of things like True Detective and, you know, that kind of rural crime, character-driven sort of thing.
Yeah.
So those are the influences. So I sent that to Matt, and Matt's like, yeah, this is cool. We should do this. And so I co-wrote the first two trades. So I guess the first eight issues I co-wrote with him. And then after that, he's like, yeah, I think you got this. You can go ahead and keep, you know, taking the rest of the way. And I just started writing it from then on out. And that's really what got me going in comics, was just having a book that's coming out every month for a couple of years. Because, you know? I think we got up to about 25 issues of Postal in this first run. We're going to go back to it and do some more, but, you know, this first run, we had about 25 issues. And just being around a lot, you know, I mean, it makes a difference. Just people are getting used to seeing, oh, you have a thing coming out.
Having a regular ongoing, like, oh, what's so-and-so doing? Oh, yeah, that one book is still coming out. Okay. All right.
Totally, man.
Yeah, like, it keeps you on the radar.
Yeah, I mean, I was like Drake for a while. I was just putting mixtapes out talking about ex-girlfriends. and people were like, oh, is he still out here? He's still out here singing? I guess he's a thing then, huh?
See,
you
know, see,
like, you got to break people down. You got to keep putting work out there. and when you start putting work out there, people are like, nah, we're not trying to recognize you right now. We don't recognize the fact that you're putting work out there. So pay that no mind and continue to put work out there, because one, you're going to build up a readership. Two, if you keep putting things out there, eventually they have to recognize OVO, right? Eventually they got to recognize, yep, all right, your thing, fine, singing and rapping from Toronto, we'll let it go, welcome.
I mean, that's real, though. That's real, though.
So basically, what happened to me, I just wouldn't go away, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just stuck around until people broke, you know, and then I was able to step up. Like, you know, I'm a Taurus, so anytime you get into a war of attrition, you know, I'm going to win. I'm more stubborn than everybody. Like, I might not knock you down, but I'm not going to fall down. So we're just going to be standing here beating each other up for 12 rounds.
Okay. I could do this all day.
You know? Because Bruce wouldn't fall down, so I'm not going to fall down. So we're going to have a long night, brother.
I like that Batman inspiration right there.
You know? Like, so that's really kind of what did it. And then, like, after Postal, like, Postal got picked up for TV development, and then that sort of helped, and then everything else kind of fell into place. You know,
that's cool. Wait, when did that happen?
Oh, that happened a while ago.
So they're working on an animated or an actual live action?
Oh, like a live action. Like I think it's hour long drama. I'm not involved in that development process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I can't speak to its details, because, you know, I kind of said what I needed to say in the comic book, and adapting that into a series, I don't find that particularly interesting.
Right. Gotcha.
Because then I'm doing what I did before, and I'm doing it in a different way. And I feel like someone else who's coming into it new can do something much less stale than I would do it.
Right.
Right. You know, like, because go ahead. No, I was going to say kind of like what they did with Walking Dead. To where, like, you know, they have two different worlds. Like, you have the comic, and then you have, of course, you know, the live action, where the comic still has its cult following, but, like, live action has just, like, a whole battalion of just, like, cult followers that just won't, like, that's their world now. And it's like, wow, it's crazy. Because whether you like the show or not, it's like, it's still a thing, and it's still huge, and it's its own little entity, which is really interesting. So,
yeah, no, well, every medium has its different needs, right? So, you know, what you do in a comic, you can't really do literally in a television show. You have to adapt it. Or a film, you know, you have to adapt it. So when it comes to my work, I'm like, if someone has a vision for how they want to do it, I'm kind of more keen to let them go ahead, unless they're like, hey, man, you know, we really need you to come in and do that. So sometimes I get questions about things, and I'll answer them, you know, whatnot. But I try to kind of keep out of that process as much as I could. But that helped, you know, get things kind of going. And then you just got to follow momentum. You know, you have to, if you're, you know, it's like your in a fight. I mean, I'm a martial artist, so I put a lot of things in the context of you know, hand-to-hand combat, sort of how I think.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're in a fight and you got the momentum, you got to keep it.
Right.
You know? Because once you lose it, it's really hard to get it back. So
it's interesting that thing you said about you know, kind of like rewriting this. You know, if I were to go to do this TV show for this thing I already wrote, it's kind of like I'm just doing the same thing over again in the same, you know, in a different, just with for a different medium. And it's kind of funny because every year that I go to Dragon Con, I make it a point to go make sure I talk to Peter David for a few minutes because he's always there. And Peter David one year was talking to a fan who basically said, you know, how come these movies and these TV shows aren't like the comics? Why are they so different? And he put it pretty much in the same perspective you just put it. Like, why would the same people want to go and write the same exact thing that was already written down? Like, that's not what we want to do as creatives. We want to make something new, updated, something different. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I kind of feel that. I kind of feel that perspective.
Yeah, you know, I'm 41 now, so I've mellowed out a little bit in my old age, you know, and so I'm not in that place where you think, if I don't succeed at this thing in 5 minutes, then I'm going to disappear.
Right.
You know, then Thanos is going to snap his fingers and I'm going to disappear. And that's how it feels. You know, you feel like, cause when you're, and I'm saying this to everyone out there who, you know, is a writer, an artist, filmmaker, musician, actor, whoever. If you're trying to do, you know, one of those road less travel sort of lifestyles, you're going to be in a place where your friends have made more stable decisions. And, because of that, you know, maybe they got a car before you got a car, or maybe their car is a lot nicer than your car. Maybe they got a house while you're still renting. Maybe they got an apartment when you're still crashing on somebody's couch.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that can work its way into your mind, and it can create a lot of doubt, and it can create a lot of frustration, and you can, you know, you can lose yourself to it if you're not careful. So I like to tell people, you're going to get there, you know, and you just got to keep focusing on your work, make yourself better every day. Change is constant, right? You're always changing.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't change whether or not you're going to change. Because that's going to happen anyway. All you can affect is whether or not you're getting stronger or getting weaker.
Exactly.
That's it.
Exactly.
That's all you got. So if you're not stronger tomorrow, then you're weaker tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And if you just keep focusing on what can make me stronger, you know, then you're going to get there. You know, like I tell people about writing a book. You know, someone says, I want to write a novel. I don't have time. And, you know, I can't get it done. How do I get it done? So I ask them, when's your birthday? And they'll say, oh, my birthday, you know, what's today? My birthday is May 23rd, right?
Mm.
So I say, okay. So it's May 23rd, 2018. If you had written one page a day since May 23rd, 2017, you'd have 365 pages written.
Huh.
Right?
Good point.
Right. Right now. You just have it done. Right? Because everything is the same thing. Don't worry about the novel. Write the page. If you keep writing the page, the novel will take care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
If you keep writing the page, the screenplay will take care of itself, right? And people have this tendency to look at the result that's in their mind and where they are and just that, right? They just see that binary, you know, that polemic of, I want novel, I have nothing. And it seemed like this great, great big canyon.
It's overwhelmed. I know the feel. I right? know the feel. You know, it's
kind of screenplay. I have nothing. Ah,
that's why NaNoWriMo was so good. Like,
yeah,
I do that. Like, I did that. I've done it for 2 years now, and I'm like, it's like, you're not even on NaNoWriMo. You're not thinking about the end product. You're just thinking, on that day, how am I going to get these 1,700 words out?
Dude, that's the Batman mind, right? That is, if I fail, Gotham burns, so I can't fail, right? You just have to put that, I am going to climb out of this hole because I have to stop Bane. I hear you. I get it. No one gets out. I understand. Basara, Basara, Desi, Desi. I get the whole thing. However, I am going to climb out of this hole.
Right, exactly. You know what? As a matter of fact, since we're on a topic, because Batman being a major inspiration, gotta ask a little bit about this Detective Comics. Now, I know you can't give out all the detail because it's about to pop out. What, June? Is that June? I want to say it's June. But yeah. Detective Comics. So being a person who grew up loving Batman, how do you feel about getting Detective Comics to write? Like, that's gotta be like, wow.
Well, I was in Toronto, working on Titans when I got the email from DC, from Chris Conroy over there. He was like, hey man, we just want to know if you're interested in writing Detective Comics. And my first thought was, oh, I didn't know you guys had Detective Comics that didn't have Batman in it. That's cool. Who's Detective? That's me. He's like, no, we mean Detective Comics, Batman. I'm like, word? yeah, for sure. You know, and then I hopped on the phone with Scott, and Scott was great. And it just kind of happened like that. I mean, I didn't campaign for it because it's arrogant to campaign for it. Like, you don't start writing books and people start paying attention to you, and then you suddenly say, hey, now it's time for you to write Batman. Like, that's just not how it goes. I know it's not how it goes, you know? And so I was just kind of doing my thing, doing the TV thing and screenwriting thing and, you know, working on, Aphrodite 5, that graphic novel's coming out this year, and relaunched the Cyber Force, and that's out on stands right now. Mm-hmm. And wrapping up Postal when, the email came in, and I was like, oh, this is great. And I think, I don't want to speak for them, but I think they were kind of pleasantly surprised that I had so much perspective on Batman.
Yeah.
You know, that.
I mean,
that
real fan. That's what.
Yeah, like, yeah. Yeah, that I get it. You know, that I get it. And they wanted me to, do something with Black Lightning, you know, and have them interact. Mm-hmm. And this isn't a spoiler or anything. I was thinking, okay, well, Jefferson's an educator. If I was Bruce Wayne, I'm not just looking at Jefferson because he can shoot lightning out of his hands. I'm looking at who that man is. Mm-hmm. And why would Bruce want an educator, to come to Gotham? Why is he trying to build that bridge? Right. And the story kind of grew out of that. And then from Jefferson's perspective, it's also, why is Batman coming to me? Mm-hmm. You know, cause Jefferson's in Metropolis, right? So he knows guys. Listen to the guy with the red boots that flies. and I imagine that guy with the red boots and that great smile might have told him, I don't know, man, be careful around Batman. You know, not for nothing, just be careful around Batman.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, he just got that. He sees that he's about to marry a villain. Like, just watch.
No, Bruce makes choices out here.
Yeah,
right. And I thought it'd be really interesting if Jefferson, was kind of like, I'm honored that you've come into my world, but I'm also giving you a little bit of side eye because I've heard you don't have friends and you only have assets. And I've got things I have to manage. I have kids that depend on me. You know, I've got things I have to do. And that interaction I thought had a lot of promise. You know, balance of perspectives. Because right. Jefferson does the day-to-day work that Bruce Wayne kind of funds, but doesn't really do.
Exactly, yeah. It's kind of like the other half that he kind of needs to... That'd be some cool interaction, yeah.
Like, because in a lot of ways, Bruce only deals with Jefferson's... with students like the ones Jefferson teaches when they fall out of the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't really get them when they're trying to, you know, stick to it and better themselves and make their circumstances better. And so I thought, I'm like, well, this is kind of a cool idea, you know, and Batman is sort of a teacher in his own way, even though he would likely deny that. But he does, you know, he has young people around him that depend on him and get instruction from him. And Jefferson, you know, also has kids that he deals with. And I just felt like, yeah, this is, it had to be more than just Black Lightning is really popular right now. Let's put him in the book. You know, like I wouldn't do that to people. Right. I really wanted to explore who these men were and frame the story around how their different perspectives kind of affect each other. And hopefully that's what I'm doing. You know, it's, I tell people that it is a, you know, Batman story. Like, right. it is a story told from a guy that wore a groove into his Danny Elfman Batman LP growing up, who still has the ticket stubs from the first movie. I have a scrapbook and it's got two ticket stubs, June 23rd, 1989, the matinee and the evening show. It's the only movie that I've ever bought a ticket for in the matinee, walked out, got a sandwich, bought a ticket, and saw the evening show. Because it just blew my mind.
Nice.
You know?
Nice. That's awesome. That's awesome. So, you know, matter of fact, going off of what you were talking about with Black Lightning. So, I mean, he just had a show. You know what I mean? First season of a show just ended. And I kind of had the mindset to kind of ask, you know, how do you feel about writing Black Lightning after the show, whatever. But at this point, I'm kind of like, if I can guess, I would say, it's like whatever. It's kind of chill about it. Sure, the show was there, but you know.
Well, I tell you what, like, you know, the show is doing excellent work. So, you know, the show I write for currently, Titans, we're in the same building with Black Lightning. Right. So I see all the Black Lightning writers coming and going, and I have some good conversations with them. You know, there's a little lunch room in the place, and we talk about things there. And they're great people, and they're doing great work, and I really dig the show. I think the difference between that incarnation of the character and what I'm doing now is their character is a little older and a little more veteran.
Right.
And my Black Lightning is a little younger and still trying to figure himself out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of the questions I have hanging over Jefferson is, where are you going with this? You know? Like, where are you going, man? Are you a Justice League guy? Mm-hmm. Are you ready for Gods and Monsters? Or are you, you know, neighborhood guy? You know, not to cross-pollinate, but, you know, are you on some Matt Murdock where you just gotta protect the kitchen?
Yeah.
Or, are you going to get out here? Are you going to mix it up with Thanos? Like, what are you all about, man? Like, what are you all about? And that's sort of what Batman's about, right? He's kind of like, listen, I see potential in you to be, you know, kind of anything you want, right? And I can help you get to that place because we need more good people in positions to do more good things. And Jefferson, I don't think has ever considered himself like Diana or Hal. Or Bruce, you know, or Clark. Like, I don't think he looks at himself like that. No. I think he's doing the best he can with the power that he has to affect change right in his radius.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't consider himself a god walking on earth, you know, and that's how he views these characters. And so for him to meet Batman, and in my story, they don't have a lot of a relationship before this story. Right. Well, that's sort of how we're playing it. This is, they might have like worked together briefly before, but they haven't really had a lot of like coffee chats and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then for him to meet Batman and realize this is just a guy in a suit. You know, like, you're just a guy. There's a great moment in one of the cartoons. I forget which one it was, but like Green Lantern is walking with Batman and Green Lantern's like, wait a minute. You're just a guy in a suit?
Justice League War.
Justice League War, yeah.
And I Batman kind of smirks, you know?
And then he takes his ring and he says, what's this?
Yeah. And that's what's like kind of amazing about the character, right? And that's what's inspiring about it, you know, I think for Jefferson is seeing this guy, he can do these things. But on the other side of that, though, there's also this question about, is Bruce crazy?
Right.
Right. Like, now that we've established what you are,
to have some level of craziness with the kind of stuff that he does. I mean,
oh yeah, just to stay sane. Yeah.
Well, it's you know, when I think about Bruce Wayne, I think about the people that I've known that have been really successful, that are really ambitious, but they only function properly when they have a war to fight.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, like some people just cannot retire. They can't vacation. They can't chill. They're mm-hmm. just not people who are made to do that. And they need a crisis. And I think, you know, those people are great for situations where crises are constantly popping up. But they need to be in a world of chaos. Otherwise, they don't really have a place, you know, in the world. They struggle. Because then, if they're not in a world of chaos, then they kind of aim all that energy internally, and then you wind up with something like Dark Knight Returns, you know, where you have a sturdy old man thinking about killing himself in a race car. And Bruce, it manifests in, you know, Gotham's greatest hero. But if you're Jefferson Pierce and you really see those motivations, you would teach a child to walk away from those feelings.
Right.
Like, no educator worth trusting would allow a kid to become Batman. You know, like, you wouldn't let Bruce follow that, right? You know, you would say, you gotta let this go. You know, you can't dominate your life like this. So yeah, all of those things I think are really interesting and a fertile ground. And then when you work the Bat family in there and how they all get there, I feel like I can get some good work done in the story, you know.
Especially since most of them are young. I'm not caught up on Detective Comics, but I did read a few issues. So if I'm not mistaken, we still got like Spoiler and I think Cassandra's still there, and I'm not sure what happened with Red Robin. I think he was there. They pretend like he died, and he didn't die, and he came back. I don't know.
Well, James Tynion in the fourth. He's done really great work fleshing out kind of how the Bat family works and who these characters are, especially Tim Drake. I think his work on Tim Drake is really, really strong. You know, kind of, because Tim was always a character that was kind of caught between other characters, right? He wasn't Jason. Right. He wasn't Dick, you know. He doesn't really have the inherent coolness of Cassandra Cain, who's just cool, right? Like, Cassandra Cain is just cool.
She's just like the one that they send in to handle a room full of bad guys, you know?
Yeah, it's like, oh, let's take Chloe Bennett and make her Bruce Lee. Yeah, that's gonna work, you know? So, like, you know, Cassie's cool was just effortless, but Tim did, James did a really good job, I think, of making Tim, mean something. And so without getting into details in the story I'm telling is about a villain that tests the purpose and the place of the Bat family within Batman's life.
Nice.
At the same time that Batman is reaching out to Jefferson Pierce to bring him in to help him deal with the people that depend on him, because Batman has a lot of things, but he's not great at bedside manner.
Right.
And I think he realizes, you know, these kids, they need things that I can't provide. And maybe you can provide them because you're both a hero and an educator.
Right. That's an interesting dynamic. I think that's going to work out really well. He's kind of like the half of Batman he's the part of Batman that Batman can't, the shoes that Batman can't fill, I guess.
Well, he's definitely the straight man in that scenario, right? Like, imagine if Jamie Foxx from Miami Vice had to team up with Christian Bale Batman. And that's a lot of, like, that's the feel of, you know, just occasionally looking at him and being like, you know you're crazy, right? you realize this is all completely insane. Okay, fine.
You're in a whole bat suit, dude.
Yeah.
Like, you put time and effort into a car that nobody's ever going to get just to ride around the city in a cow with spiked ears.
It's crazy. It's crazy. And that's been the most fun I've been having, is kind of like, you know, the best experience in writing is when it doesn't feel like you're writing. It's when you are kind of just writing down what's already happening in your head, and the scenes play themselves out, and the characters start talking to each other, and you don't feel like you're generating any of it. You're just chronicling it.
Right.
And that's what this feels like. So I have this 5-issue arc, starts at number 983, and I'm trying to make the best of it. You know, the stuff that I grew up that really affected me were essentially, you know, 4 or 5 issues. Whether you're talking about like Dark Knight Returns or Batman Year One or Morrison's Arkham Asylum, like, these weren't year-long runs of anything, but they were just filled with purpose and narrative strength and philosophy and you know, and ideas. And that's the kind of work that I'm trying to do here with this run.
That's awesome. I mean, it's just so cool to be able to write your favorite hero after all those years, and then, you know, be able to implement another character. I mean, like, when somebody gives you a character to say, hey, this guy needs to be in the book, i.e., that being, Black Lightning, it's kind of like the fun part is figuring out, okay, well, can this character mesh with this other one? You know, how can this work out? Because they just tell you to do it, and they expect you to do all the handiwork. So, I mean, that's fun in itself.
Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Switching gears a little bit from the DC side to the Marvel side. So would Miles.
Another one. I've been talking to Chris Robinson, editor over at Marvel, for a long time. And, you know, we've been trying to find something to do together. And he, you know, he reached out, about this annual. And I was like, yeah, that'd be really cool. And Nelson was interested in doing it. And I haven't worked with Nelson since Romulus. And you guys are so great about supporting Romulus. Really appreciate it. And so anytime I can work with Nelson again, that's always fun. So yeah, I mean, he's just a fun character to write, and it's a fun world to write. And the kineticism of it is interesting to me. And if in Detective, you get this kind of David Fincher meets Michael Mann meets Nolan operatic sort of thing, you know, the Miles story gets to be more kinetic and influenced by different things, influenced by everything from like Capcom video games, anime, obviously Bendis's work, and mm-hmm. a bunch of other deals. And so you get to kind of exercise different parts of your imagination. And so that should be a lot of fun. And Nelson's a brilliant artist, so I know it's going to look really good.
Oh, Nelson's great, man. I love the work in Romulus. I mean, I could talk about Romulus all day.
Super, super smart guy too. Like, Nelson's so smart. So, mm-hmm. It's great when you're working with someone and they can make your story better. When they have, you know, they can add things to the narrative. Right. They understand what you're trying to layer in and the rest of it. So, yeah, hopefully we're going to come up with something pretty special. I mean, not many people have written Miles, you know, and so there's a legacy to uphold, I think, when it comes to that.
So far, I think has it just been Bendis? Like, as far as like the main book?
It might have just been Brian. Might have just been Brian. And, you know, Brian was one of the nicest people to me before I was even close to professional. I remember talking to Bendis on a message board he used to have back when we used message boards. Mm-hmm. And it's cool. He just answered questions and just be a really friendly guy. And so there's definitely a sense of responsibility in trying to uphold the high standard of work that he's done. So, you know, cross my fingers. This will be a worthy addition to the the compendium of that character.
Right, right. I'm interested to see what people would do with him next. I mean, of course, Ben has established a great basis for him, and I don't think the next writer I got announced for him yet. I could be wrong, but I thought I saw something about the name like Spidey or something like that. His name being changed. Not 100% of those details.
I'll be honest. I only know what I'm doing at the moment. Mm-hmm. Like, y'all probably know more about what I'm doing than I know. Like, I just don't pay any attention to, like, the upcoming and the thing and the other thing. And the other
there's
thing.
So much information, dude.
Man. You just drown in it. You drown in information.
Yeah. I mean, even running these sites, these comic sites, like, I mean, thank God, like, dude, in comic book, we have a huge, you know, like, a lot of people, like, writers and staff, you know, whatever, and they know way more information than I would know individually. I mean, it's incredible all the news that comes out. This solicits news. You know, and people are like, they look at the fine print and they infer things and then it gets turned into big articles and it's crazy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, comics is like the satellite moon of hip hop in a way, you know? It's like, yeah. It has like the same sort of thing. The rumor mill is out there. The people get real hype. There's diss tracks getting put out on people. You know, everyone tries to Meek Mill you every now and then, you know, like, so it's kind of a crazy game. You know, it's a real crazy game. I do the best I can to stay as positive as possible with my online interactions and talking about the work and talking to readers, and because, you know, getting to the place where you're able to do that, where you have a platform, and I don't have a huge platform, I got a tiny little footprint, but being able to even have that tiny little footprint, I'm so grateful to everybody who supports the work and sends me the nice messages online. Like when you announce, like, hey, I'm doing this Miles annual, and you get all these like positive messages, like, hey man, that's great. I've been reading Romulus. I think Romulus is great. And, you know, I think it'll be good. Or
some power ray. It's like, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. You're like, oh, you don't even know. Like, you don't know everyone who's experiencing your work, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you just, there's no way to know. Even the people that tweet you, every person that tweets you something represents like 10, 15 people who've never tweeted you, who just read your stuff, right?
Right, right.
So I'm focused on making sure that no one interacts with me on a social media platform and has a bad experience that ruins their enjoyment of the books that they bought, right? Like, I think it's just a bummer if you read somebody's work, you like somebody's work, and you go to Twitter feed, and the Twitter feed is just all anger, right? Like, that sucks. I don't want that. Like, imagine if you watched Star Wars and you went to George Lucas's Twitter feed and was all like, I'm really mad about the donut I had today.
Oh, my God. Star Wars hurts my... Yeah. That's a whole nother thing. That hurts my feelings because I actually like all the Star Wars things that are coming out. I've liked... I mean, it's just always little things that I don't like, you know. Because I have little critiques, but I've liked most of it. And, you know, I go to check the Star Wars hashtag one day, you know. Just like, oh, let me go see what people are saying. I see all... Not from creators, but from fans or ex-fans or whatever they call themselves now. Just bashing, like, episode 8. And I'm like, oh, let me get out of here, because I just wasn't expecting all that, you know? So, but yeah, like, going on your page and seeing, like, all the positive stuff. I mean, sometimes I just scroll the Twitter feed every once in a while. Let me see what's going on. And every time I see something of yours, it's always an inspirational thing, usually about writing. And I really appreciate that, because, like, it's good to see inspiration come from creators. I mean, writing is like you feel like you're alone, man. It's like you're sitting in this dark room and you got an open, empty Word document, and you're just like, it's just me and you. Microsoft Word.
You literally just described Hunter S. Thompson's entire life. All right.
But yeah, it's great to see, like, positive reinforcement from creators on Twitter, so you definitely provide that. From the going back again one more time. Let the sirens pass.
Gotham is crying.
Yeah, right. That's what I feel like right now. Oh, Gotham City.
My city screams behind me. I'm doing a podcast. I'll have to save you later.
I've caused most of the damage, but, you know,
Oh, that's a whole other conversation with what Batman has done to Gotham. But, no.
Right? I'm actually on a rooftop right now, standing on a gargoyle. I forgot to tell you about
that. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, cool. Just waiting for the bat signal.
Up here.
Waiting for the bat signal.
This lady's getting mugged. Right under me, but, you know, it's not as important as
the
podcast.
It's not as important, you know? I was like, you know?
So, actually, speaking of screwed up worlds.
Yeah.
Michael Cray.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. The Justice League, man.
Well, that's all Warren Ellis, right? So,
right.
So, Rob Levin, the guy that I mentioned earlier, he moved over to DC, and now he's working with Marie Javins over in DC. And so Rob reached out and was like, hey, you know, we're thinking about talking to people about this Wildstorm spinoff. Would you be interested? And I was like, yeah, you know, sure. Send me whatever you got. And they sent, you know, the thing over, and it was from Warren, because Warren was writing the Wildstorm. Mm-hmm. And Warren just like, yeah, we're going to kill some DC heroes. And I was like, okay, so Warren has said it, so shall it be done, right? And that's really how that started. I mean, that was Warren's original idea,
right?
Was kind of, you know, perverting the Justice League.
That sounds like a war nightmare. It really does.
Putting Michael Gray against him, and then they got Steve Harris do the art on that, and I thought it was kind of a neat idea. It was sort of cool. I told him there's one rule. I'm not going to kill Batman.
Yeah.
Because, you know, reasons.
Yeah, oh, of course.
Besides that.
It's kind of funny. Yeah, the only thing of Wildstorm I really know is the Authority. So.
Yeah, for sure.
That's the main thing. Like, when I think of Wildstorm, that's the thing that pops in my head. I think about those stories, and oh my goodness. Just.
well, Warren's work was a huge influence on me when I was just reading comics. Because he was one of those guys that was shattering the possibilities of what could be done in the comic book every time he'd write something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're like, okay, this, you know, he's awesome. So you get in a situation where suddenly you're talking to Warren about his world and doing some work in it. It's pretty nuts.
Yeah.
You know, it's like directing Tom Cruise or something. You know, you're, I don't even know what's cut, I guess. Moving on. Excellent. You know, so yeah, the Warren was so awesome. And he's like, listen, we want you to, you know, do some stuff, do whatever you want to do. I have some ideas and some guidelines, but it's your book, man. You go ahead and do it. And with the second half of this series, I'm able to do a little bit of a deeper dive. Because the first half, I sort of go through a few of those DC heroes. But in the second half of the series, I deal with John Constantine, our version of him, and Diana Prince, our version of her. And it's I describe the first half as like a series of pulp action short stories.
Okay.
And then I think the second half is almost like a Bond film in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Where you get a little bit more of a tapestry, and there's more intrigue, and it's a little sexier, and a little, you know, it's got a little more like in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a good evolution. So if anyone listening now, you can pick up the back issues that are out there, and I think the first trade comes out not too long from now, and we are doing the second half of those issues that are coming out in the floppies now, so you can still catch on. And for anyone who hasn't been keeping up with the Wildstorm and any of that, I mean, one, you should keep up with the Wildstorm because it's really good, but two, if you're just kind of interested in Cray, the book won't lose you. You don't need to have read all of this stuff in order to kind of find out what's happening in the book. And that was one of Warren's things, was he wanted someone to be able to read that book and just kind of get it.
I've been yelled at about not being caught up on Wildstorm and Cray. You know, it's like, oh man, you have, do you even comic book? Do you even comic book? You're not reading Wildstorm?
Do you even comic book, bro? You're not even on the Cray, bro.
and it's funny because I actually have all of the issues. It's just like sitting here, right here to my right in my comic box.
As Dominic Toretto says, were you granny shifting when you should have been double clutching?
Well,
you might have never had your car.
Right.
you never had your car. But yeah, no, check it out. It's cool. It's definitely kind of like stark and intense, and action is sort of like in the front seat in that book.
Yeah. I mean, I was so hyped. I was like, first I saw Michael Cray and I was like, oh snap. Okay. It's Michael Cray is here again. Cause I hadn't read, like again, only Authorities were all really super into, but I had heard of him. You know what I mean? So I was like, okay, cool. And then I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh, it's Brian. I'm definitely going to cop this. So I put it on my pull list. I got all the issues. And then I just never got around to picking them up yet. It's like a billion comics out there, man. And
there's so many, man. And they each cost a sandwich.
Dang. Man, that's a good way of putting it.
Cruel.
Oh, that's a good way of putting it, yeah. Oh, it's sad. That's a sandwich, that's man.
No, it's true, though. Like, that's my rule. Like, when I write a comic book, I read it, and I say, is this experience as good as a sandwich? And if it's not, I go back there and I rewrite it until it is.
I mean, I could sit there and eat a sandwich.
That's the thing, right?
Comic book.
No. That's some scary thinking, man.
I know, because there's some good sandwiches out here.
Like, especially if you're broke and you're just looking for entertainment, just like, all right, man, do I want to get entertained over and over?
I had to make that
choice. I want a sandwich.
I had to make that choice.
I mean, honestly, I feel so blessed in my older, I'm not that old, in my older years as opposed to younger years, because I used to have to, like, decide, like, just look, sit there in comic book stores and really decide between, like, two different issues of a comic that I could grab, you know, like, oh man, do I get the Avengers or do I get Justice League? I don't know, man. it's kind of tough. And, you know, now obviously stuff is more expensive nowadays, but, I can grab a few more issues at least. So, you know, I'm glad to actually have all of Michael Gray sitting there and I can dive in whenever I want. So it's always nice to know that. And eat a sandwich.
that's a sandwich. Dang, that's scary. Nah, like, cause I struggle. That's real. Nah.
Now I'm gonna be thinking about that every time exactly. I go to write something. Is this better than a sandwich?
I'm gonna be thinking, like, if I ever go broke again, I'm just like, oh man, like, nah, like, it's either this sandwich or like I go to the comic book store and just look at them and like I'll never get my time back. So it's like, dude, like.
Sometimes comics is better than a sandwich. I mean, sometimes you might decide to just feel hungry because you got to read the next issue of Michael Gray.
Hey, man. Oh, speaking of, so I also, like, I have the first two issues, but I just haven't gotten around to reading them because I think it was either him or somebody else in the. Matter of fact, no, it was another person that's in the DM comic book community. His name is Michael T. Ford, and, he convinced me. He's like, oh man, yeah, Michael Cray is really good. And I was like, okay, I'll go in the store and check it out. And the first issue I saw was the issue where he's firing and Green Arrow's arrows are coming towards the wall at his head. And I'm like, oh, hold on, we got something interesting here. All right, let's go ahead. So right then and there, I was like, all right. So I never really got too into Wildstorm, like even when I was younger. Aside from like what he was saying, like Authority, and recently I went back and read Midnighter and Apollo, mm-hmm. and I was like, you know what, why not? So let's test the waters on this. And here I am, like, I forgot when issue 2 came out, but I think there was about like 3 issues out at the time, and I was like, you know, I'll get around to this one day. So I promise you, I will get around to it one day, and I'll message you. I was saying,
it's all good, man. Like, there are a gajillion books out, you know, right now. There's so many, many books out there. And the great thing about working on, you know, Detective and you know, the Miles Annual and these things being announced is that people are, oh, that's interesting. Who is this guy? Oh, he wrote this. I might not have picked that up. I'm gonna go pick that up now. Oh, I'll read some Romulus, you know. And so, the great thing about books is books go on forever. They're just there forever. It's not like music or something where, you know, you drop an album and if nobody listens to it at the time, no one's gonna find that record, right? Mm-hmm. But with a book, people will go back and they'll read some of the earlier works and they'll get in when they get in on someone. You know, I'm like
always
I
reading old stuff always.
Yeah. You know, like, I read Silence of the Lambs first because that was the one I'd heard of because of the film. Mm-hmm. And then when I read that and really liked it, I just looked up anything else Thomas Harris had written, and that was Black Sunday, Red Dragon, and all that, and got back into it. So books have this permanence that I really appreciate. So, you know, people, you know, if you hear me on this podcast, you're like, I've never heard of this guy. I think he's their cousin or something, but he sounds cool. You know, Google some Brian Hill comics and pick a couple up.
Man, if they Google your comics, they're going to be so overwhelmed because there are so many comics that I didn't even know about that you wrote.
I told you, I am the Drake of comics.
Yeah. I mean, and then like these other books, like, and I see your Twitter all the time. You're mentioning other books and I can't even keep track of it. I'm like, okay, Aphrodite 5. Try to remember that. And then I go back and look up like, oh yeah, that's coming out again. Like I forgot and then remember it again. Like, oh, okay.
Oh yeah. No, we out here. Like it's going down, man. I love telling stories. And so I get every opportunity I get to do it, I definitely jump on it. You know, I try to be as prolific as I can. You know, while maintaining quality. Mm-hmm. But it's just so awesome. When you write a screenplay or you're writing a TV script or something, there's a lot of time. I mean, with a screenplay, you're lucky if they make it. I've only had one screenplay of mine that's sold that's been actually produced. That's Dolph Lundgren movie.
Right.
With a TV show, you know they're going to make what you write, But there's still a lot of time before you get to really experience it.
Mm-hmm.
But with a comic, you write a comic book script, in a matter of weeks, you are experiencing that story visually. And then in a few more weeks, consumers are experiencing that story. And when you're working on something that has multiple issues like Postal, you're getting feedback in near real time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're able to see what is affecting people about your narrative, and you can make adjustments almost like you're producing a track, you know, kind of based on, mm-hmm. you know, the feel in the room, or like you're DJing, I guess is a better way to say it. You know, you're like you're DJing and throwing a track on here, and you kind of see what the crowd's responding to, and that gives you an idea, and it's like, oh, if you like that, then let me go ahead and get this Tupac Banks mashup on here. Y'all gonna really feel that, you know? Y'all ain't ready for that one. So we're gonna bring that record out now. And that's the great part. There's so much energy, in just in the medium and among the consumers and all of that. I think the readers of mine that have found my work solely through comics, I think have a closer relationship to, you know, who I am as a creator than someone would have if they watch one of my movies or watch the show or whatever it is, because the comic book is really me just kind of creating in my home office, expressing what I want to express in the moment. And so it really is a snapshot of where I was in that point in time.
Right, right. Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. Talking about this, you mentioned, you know, being office, home creating. Writing process rise. So like for, you know, writers, you know, people who are like, okay, I want to write, but I have no idea how to write a comic. I have no idea how to structure a story. If somebody told me to write Batman tomorrow, I'd probably faint and die. Like what kind of advice, forget advice for a second. what's kind of your process that works for you? Like when you sit down.
Well, I learned something from Jeff Johns while I was working on Titans.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff does a thing where sometimes he'll chart out a story in terms of its emotional beats first.
Mm-hmm.
And not like plot, you know, just like the emotion.
Okay.
What are we trying to make people feel from moment to moment to moment? And that's really effective for me. So that's how I kind of think about the stories. I sort of think about, what are the emotions here? You know, what do I want the reader to feel moment to moment? And then the plot and the characters start to bubble up and start seeing some moments. And then those moments, they turn into images. You drop those images down and they will eventually become panels and all of that. So my first stage in the process is really just a lot of freestyle stuff. I mean, you know, it's the same kind of process I use if I'm writing a song or something.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just sit at the keys and I'll put a little metronome on, and I'll just start playing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll just start playing some stuff. And eventually a melody shows up, you know, like you start, you know, like you're just kind of tinkling and doing some things, and maybe throw a couple chords in there, and like, okay, this sounds all right. And then suddenly you get like a little chord change that kind of sticks around, and you hear a little melody, you start playing the melody, and before you know it, you're writing a song. And that's sort of how my process is with writing. The first stage is just improvising, just moments, whatever I see, just kind of almost stream of consciousness in Microsoft Word until I feel like I have enough down. And then I take a look at it and I start to refine it a little bit, you know, start to kind of structure it a little bit. And then your act structure shows up.
Do you allow yourself to kind of, I guess dwell on the process, you know, kind of sit back in a chair, dwell on it, as opposed to speed writing? Cause I feel like some people that I know, at least on my level, they're like, well, I'm not getting anything done and I have nothing written down. And, you know, it's been a week or something like that. You know, I gotta have this down by, you know, I don't know, Monday or something like that. Do you feel like it's a process where it's like, okay, I need to have this many pages done by today, or do you think it's a process more like I need to dwell on this until it hits a point where it organically creates itself?
Well, for me, I like to kind of force myself to get to the bad draft as soon as possible.
Okay.
Right? Okay. Like just get to it. Like the moment I think I have enough there where I can start writing something, and I know it's not going to be right, that's mm-hmm. fine. just get the bad draft out of you. And then once the bad draft is out, I might sit back a little bit. You know, I might listen to some music or watch some movies that have the same kind of tone that I'm trying to achieve, or, you know, play a video game that feels the same way I'm trying to get there. And I do let things bake in the oven a little bit. Okay. You know, kind of take the expectation of, I'm going to sit here and I'm going to write a draft, and then I'm going to drink some water, and then I'm going to write another draft, and I'm going to drink some water. No. No, I write the draft, I get to the end, so I know I have something that can be structured into a story. I have placeholder dialogue. You know, sometimes in dialogue, I'll write, like, what the subtext is, because I don't even want to think about a line, because I just want to keep moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
So, to be like, you know, panel one, Batman says something very Batman-y. Panel two, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense, yeah.
I'll just, you know, you figure that out later. But, you know, I like to get all that in there, and then that's when the most fun part of the process is the redrafting. So, after I get that first garbage draft out, then I might show to an editor, you know, depending on the relationship I have with the editor.
Mm-hmm.
Some editors you're just kind of closer to, and you can let them, you feel comfortable letting them in earlier in the process. Some editors you don't want to send things until it's a little bit later on in the process. But, once that's out, then I'll just kind of swim around in the feelings of it for a little bit and see what bubbles up, you know, like, actively get my mind off of the writing part, doing other things, but the stuff starts to percolate, you know, when you stop focusing on it.
Right.
And then when it starts to lock in a little bit, I'm like, oh, you know what, if I do this, then I can do that, then he could say this, then she could say that, and that'd be cool. You know what, this should be set here instead of there, this is more visually interesting than this is. And you can almost feel like your bucket filling up,
mm-hmm.
and then when I feel like, oh, you know what? My bucket's so full, I can't put any new things in there. Now it's time to go write that second draft.
Right.
And then I go do that. I go for a walk, you know, I'll hit the heavy bag.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of whatever, just to kind of sort of, just kind of shake it loose a little bit and see what comes up.
Right. I think that's, to me, that seems like the smartest way to do things, because rush writing feels like you're forcing it. It just feels like it's not going to be real. You know what I mean? Like, it's not going to be, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not going to be, it's not going to be really you. It's going to be like this forced version of, oh, I need to get this thing out, but it's not really what I wanted to be yet because I rushed it because I'm trying to get to the next whatever.
Well, it's a lot like, it's like singers, right? Like, most singers don't start with lyrics. You know, most of the time, they got that beat. You know, they got the music, they got the melody, they got the harmony, there's some structure there. Mm-hmm. And they get into the booth, and they sometimes just sing gibberish.
Exactly. See?
Until they find it. You know? Until exactly. they find it. They just kind of get in there and do it. I mean, you can go online. I think YouTube has them up. There's some takes of Phil Collins doing In the Air Tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just kind of making some stuff up, you know. He's a piece of love, you know. And I, you know, he doesn't have the lyrics yet. Oh Lord, you know. And so,
that's how it's got to be. I kind of feel that. But I mean, I'm not a musician or a singer. I used to call myself rapping. I can rap okay. But,
that's the same thing that you get it. Sometimes you just gotta freestyle.
Yeah, like when you're rapping, you sit there and you're trying to figure out the flow, and you just go, da 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 da. You know, you don't have words yet. You're just trying to catch where the flow is, and then words start to form out of it. And then that's why
a good friend of mine is a rapper. I don't want to like name drop him on a podcast because he'd get mad about it. But,
I got you.
and that's, I've seen him get told what the hook to the track was, right? Goes into the studio, just starts making some stuff up, and then suddenly there's a much better hook somewhere in one of his freestyles. And you're like, right. Yo, that's the hook right there. Like, you need to take that, and yeah, you have to give yourself the freedom to make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the freedom, you know, that you're making mistakes within, you're also going to find the gold. And it's a really important thing for the editor-writer relationship, for the director-actor relationship, for the producer-musician relationship. You know, you gotta create an environment where people can mess up. And they can make a wrong choice, they can be off-key, or they can get the pattern of the rhythm wrong. Because in that space, they're going to find that really good thing. And then you're going to know when you found it, and you're going to draw a red circle around it, and you're going to keep that, and you can build a whole thing on top of it.
Right. I think the moral here is just spend time on it, you know? Let it marinate. Write some stuff out. Let it marinate. Go back and write some more. I mean, it's always going to, I mean, it's, it and here's never a, here's a pro fails. Like, even in my noobish starting to write things, every time I just do it anyway, even if it's bad, and I leave and come back, it always, like, the way it coalesces, it's almost like magic. It's like, wait, like, how come I didn't see this, like, a couple of days ago when I was writing it, and I can see it now? It always does it. I don't know how.
Yeah, like the best tip that I can give people is work on multiple things simultaneously. Don't work on one thing and they're going to finish that, get to the next thing. Work on different things at the same time. That way, when you kind of hit a wall on one thing, you can move to the other thing.
Right.
And then you're going to do a little bit on that. And then while you're doing that, you're going to get ideas for the first thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're going to take those ideas over to the first thing, and then you can keep being productive. I learned that from a lecture that James Cameron gave when I was at NYU.
Oh, nice.
And somebody asked him, like, well, you know, give us one bit of advice. And he's like, write, you know, multiple things. Mm-hmm. That way you're always creating something and you're always finishing things, but you can't get burned out. Because the moment you get burned out on Terminator, then you start writing the alien. You know, like, you just kind of, you know, figure it out, right? Like, you work in the Avatar and you do the Battle Angel Alita, you know. And so... You know,
I forgot that's coming out.
A lot of people forgot that's coming out. They need to start marketing that. You know, you just want to kind of keep creating. I worked in advertising for a little bit out of NYU. And that was one of the things that we did in advertising. We were conceiving campaigns and, you know, you're talking to clients. You just want to kind of create some stuff and mess around and work on different things. And you might learn something from the sneaker company might not like a thing that you did, but then the car company might really like that, right? And you wouldn't have found it if you hadn't been working on the sneaker company and knew how to do it and vice versa.
Right.
So, yeah, like kind of keeping a bunch of different burners going on the oven, I think allows me to always have somewhere for the creative energy to go, even if I hit a little bit of a hurdle along.
Man, you're like, Chef Ramsay with like four stoves and like 16 burners going.
What are you doing?
I just watched Chef Ramsay on an episode of that little, the kid Master Chef, he was working with like three stoves at the same time.
I got a soft spot for Gordon Ramsay, man. Gordon Ramsay makes a lot of sense. He whips them up into shape.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, like I think that's it gets you in the habit of creating, you know, and as long as you're creating something, you're getting better at creating and it's going to make your work better. But I think when you sit down, you handcuff yourself to the chair, and you're like, I'm gonna write this thing. Well, you get like performance anxiety, and then it starts to get really technical, and then you're not really having any fun. Mm-hmm. I think you just gotta let yourself explore. So, like, sometimes I'll just write a speech for a character that I know is not gonna go into the thing. I know I'm not gonna use it. But in writing that speech, I learned something about the character, or if I need to figure out a couple characters, I'll just write like another scene that I know is not going to go into the thing, but I need to see them interact. I got to do that a little bit. So what happens if they went to the store? What happens if they, you know, what would that be like? Until I get a strong sense of who that character is, and then I can go back into my plot and I can put those details in.
Right. Kind of a random question.
Yeah.
Have you ever read Save the Cat?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's the Blake Snyder book. Yeah. I'm a big fan of Save the Cat. I mean, the books that I recommend to people if they're trying to study writing are, Save the Cat is good.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit of a shorthand though, and it can kind of turn into a crutch, so I supplement it. So.
Right, that's my thoughts.
Save the Cat is good. Look at Christopher Vogler's The Hero's Journey.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets into Joseph Campbell and Campbellian structure. Campbell himself can be very, very dense. Now, I am a big fan of it, so I'm a big fan of, you know, The Hero with a Thousand Faces or The Mass of God, those Campbell books, but they can be really, really dense. The Vogler book, the Hero's Journey, distills a lot of the Campbell into something that's a bit more reader friendly. Right. And then if from there you go to Campbell, you won't be as kind of, you know, lost in the deep end of the waters, because Campbell has a tendency to, because he knows all these myths and he's written about all these things, he just jumps from thing to thing a lot. And you're like, well, you know, it's like in the Epic of Gilgamesh when this is happening, which is quite similar to Gilgamesh. And you're like, okay, so let's slow your role play. But it's really good. And then to supplement the Campbell stuff, there's these conversations that Joseph Campbell had with a guy named Bill Moyers called The Power of Myth. And these are conversations they had just going back and forth. So it's just people talking, mm-hmm. and you can learn a lot from that stuff. I think now people have soured a bit on Campbellian structure. I mean, Lucas obviously swore by it because Star Wars is just Joseph Campbell.
Yeah.
But,
like through and through.
And I don't mean that to be a detriment. I'm just, you know, it's just, that's the narrative form. And I think people, I think they interpret mythology as being sexist and, you know, not having an, evolved worldview when it comes to issues of gender or even like race relations in some cases and all of that. But, while those points, I understand those points and they can be valid, I do think there is an anthropological element to it. There's a reason why we like messianic stories. There's a reason why we like stories about purpose, struggle, achievement, failure, death, and rebirth. Right? Like, we respond as creatures to this the same way we respond to the smell of warm, you know, warm dinner. The same way we respond to cold rain. Like, it's hardwired into us. Stories happen because people had to explain darkness. Mm-hmm. You know, stories happen because you needed a shaman in the village to explain winter and to make you feel like the sun was going to return, right? The seasons themselves have narrative structure. You know, we go from spring to summer to fall to winter back to spring, right?
Right.
So we go through this cycle of death and rebirth and all of this, and stories reflect that. So when you study that stuff, you understand more of why people relate to characters the way that they do. And I think Campbell is very good for that. And the final thing I would recommend is a book by J. Michael Straczynski. I forgot what it's called. It might be called The Elements of Screenwriting. Don't quote me on that. But I believe Straczynski's only written one book about writing.
It's not the Screenwriter's Bible, is it?
Maybe the Screenwriter's Bible. Maybe that's what it is.
We'll double check on that.
Anyway, the J. Michael Straczynski book about screenwriting, whatever it's called, is an awesome resource. It's got everything from structure, characterization, format, even a bit about the business. I think it's brilliant. Oh, I lied. There's one more book I'll recommend. I think everyone should have a copy of Stephen King's Songwriting.
Oh, yeah.
Did it seem like I had a message?
Yeah.
I think that man said that when he said something crazy like he reads for 17 hours a day and sleeps for six or something like that.
Yeah.
Or I'm sorry, not sleeps for six, writes for six.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. When do you sleep?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he wrote Carrie when he was 19.
Really?
Right. Yeah. He was like 19 years old when he wrote Carrie.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's incredible. Crazy.
Craziness, you know. And his book is great. And King is a guy with zero pretensions. So he just talks in such a plain way about grammar, syntax, structure, you know.
Carrie is so academic. Like, the movie is kind of like, you know, the movie's kind of like, oh, you know, it's the girl, you know, you get the major themes of the story and the people picking on the girl. But the book, it really dives deep into like the newspaper clippings and whatnot and these articles.
Yeah, well, he was a teacher when he was doing that writing too. I mean, he was 19 when he wrote that book, but then he was still like teaching and, you know, came out of high school, was doing some stuff. So, right. You know, it's all like incorporated in there. But I think those are great resources. If you buy those books and you read them, they'll certainly make your storytelling better.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. That's awesome. So, yeah, man. Okay, so we got some, man, we talked about what? Batman, Miles, Michael Cray, Postal, the several stove tops and burners we got, the Brian has going. Writing information is always good. People love it. And I love that you always tweet so much writing, positive writing information on your Twitter. I know I said that earlier, but that's good stuff. So we've pretty much made it to the end of the interview session or what have you.
Oh, cool.
So, I mean, unless you have any other thoughts or whatnot, anything else you want to say to people or any about any work you have coming out or advice? Well,
I think very soon, my Hong Kong Fooey Black Lightning crossover one shot will be in stores.
Oh!
And you don't want to miss that, because that's okay. Doing the art for that, and it's set in the 70s, and it's that like Shaw Brothers Bruce Lee film meets Big Trouble in Little China kind of thing going on.
Oh, yeah.
I just read it today, and it's absurd and kind of awesome. So make sure you get that.
For sure.
Make sure everyone, you know, goes out there and pulls my Detective Comics 983. Make sure you get that. That's coming. And then the Miles Annual. And I think that is all for right now. Aphrodite 5, you can also pre-order that. I mean, that's, you know, for everybody to kind of mention what it's about. It's basically RoboCop meets Ghost in the Shell in Los Angeles. Five minutes into the future. Nice. And it's, very kind of action heavy. Jeff Spokes did the art on that. It's amazing. So, you should definitely, it's amazing. It's one of the best comic books you've ever seen. It's amazing. I was trumping out there a little bit.
Right. All right. So
many people have said that it's one of the best books they've ever read, and you should definitely buy it and show that you have good taste as well.
You have that down perfectly.
So, I mean, I'm out here, man. So, you know, I tell you, anyone listening to this is real quick, follow me on Twitter, @Brian with a Y, @BrianEdwardHill. I'm out there, man. Ask me questions about writing, about how to get started in entertainment, about cocktail recipes, whatever. and I will get back to you, when I have some time while I'm doing the draft.
Yeah, most definitely. Oh, there's one more thing before you escape.
No.
you can't escape without what we do here in Wakanda Forever is the supersonic question session. So.
Okay.
So what it is.
Supersonic question section.
Right? I need an announcement or announcer voice for that.
Yeah.
But, supersonic question session. We kind of ask you like, this or that, and or open-ended questions that are pretty short, but you have to answer them quickly. You can provide explanations, but you have to answer them relatively quickly, so it's kind of like your first thought kind of thing, you know?
Okay.
So we'll hit a couple of those really quick.
You may fire when ready, Commander.
So actually, here's a easy, I don't know if it's easy or not, but, here's a good one to start off with. Would you go with, Michael Cray or Luke Cage?
Luke.
Okay.
Because Luke's nicer than Michael is.
True that.
You know, I mean, he's just a nicer dude, man. So like, if I was going to do something with dude, then I'd do it with Luke. I don't know about Michael. I have to watch him. Michael tends not to be witnesses out here, so. Watch that dude. That brother is a little intense.
All right. Let's go. Who's your favorite? How's your Star Wars? Are you into Star Wars or kind of?
Oh yeah, man. I know about a little Star Wars, man. I know my way around Alderaan. I know my way around Endor.
Okay. Who's your favorite Sith or Dark Side user?
Darth Vader.
All right.
Come on.
Like that answer.
The best villain in the history of all cinema. I mean, yeah, that's easy. That's a softball question.
That's another good question to have on here. Favorite villain, any fandom, or any movie, TV, comic, whatever.
Hannibal Lecter.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Alright, okay.
I think that's my sister's answer for that question. She's always talking about him. Darkseid or Thanos?
Darkseid is.
Oh! My soul! Oh. No, but you're right. Darkseid is Thanos.
We can have opinions.
Okay, if you're in a dystopian future, would you rather pick let's go with Terminator's future or Richard, why can't I think of the name of the movie right now? Richard Decker's Blade Runner's future.
Blade Runner, definitely Blade Runner.
Okay, I think that's a little bit safer. A lot safer.
Yeah. Blade Runner. But if you have money, Blade Runner's all right.
True.
Right?
But true.
You gotta make some paper, and then you're fine. If you make some paper in the Blade Runner world, then you can be married to Angela Bassett forever.
Do you think you'd be able to make it as a Blade Runner, retiring replicants?
Yeah, eventually, right? Like, I mean, they're making sex robots right now, right? So, like, it's on the way. I honestly think it's a matter of cost, honestly. I think we're certainly going, maybe in our lifetime, if not, then, you know, in the next generation, you're going to see lifelike robots that might be indistinguishable from people. And the question is whether or not they are willing to spend the money that it would take to give them an independent consciousness, one. Two, is giving them an independent consciousness anything that would actually help, you know, them achieve their goals? Like, I'm not sure they'd ever really want a thing to get to sentient, because once a thing is sentient, then you've got the same problems you have with a person. Essentially, you just have the same problems with the person, except they're stronger, faster, and smarter.
Exactly.
So, yeah. You know, but I think, yeah, it's certainly possible for sure. Okay.
You saw Animatrix, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you remember, like, the uprise of the androids and just, like, okay, yeah, so that's exactly, like, what I think of, like, every time I see a sex robot or, like, a sex doll, because, yes, I live in Austin, Texas, and they have a sex doll plant, which I was like, so, y'all hiring? I mean, I don't want one, but, like, I'm not going to deny it if you got one. No, I'm just joking.
Was a Japanese woman with, like, purple hair running through it shooting everybody?
No. Oh, my God.
When you say plant that makes robots,
not a plant, but, like, a factory. And it's crazy because, like, you can literally, and they have a website, you can literally make your, what you envision as the perfect female or other. And I'm just like, oh, this is scary.
Scary.
Like,
I would say scary is the word.
there's a whole human being out there that takes, like, tax dollars and just, like, says, let's do this. Like, yo, I'm just, like, perplexed. Like, there's a whole being out there that literally didn't even, like, sometimes didn't even just, like, take the time out. He was like, yeah, I just want this. Yeah, like, that right there, that with the curls, the bangs, the purple streak. Yeah, she has to be Asian because that's what they all look like, right? you know, it's weird. Like, just, like...
Well, there's always going to be people that want to objectify other people, and when they can actually make objects that are people, I don't see why they would stop, right?
Like, right.
It's, you know, I don't know where it goes, you know, honestly. There's so many implications for, like, what it does to our society. You know, and I see the pluses and the minuses and all that stuff. It freaks me out a little bit, frankly, because I grew up in the 80s and you don't trust robots. So robots are, the only time you trust a robot is when it's the robot fighting the other evil robot in the same story. If there's just one robot in the story, it's trying to kill you.
With that, like, what about J5?
I guess Johnny 5 was alright. Right. Johnny 5 was pretty good, you know. No disassemble. So, yeah, he was good. But that's a rare case, though, man. You got a whole lot of X209s and T800s before you get to one Johnny Five. You know what I mean?
Right.
And they made Johnny Five to be a killer. He just wasn't, right? But they were trying to make a killer. So even that, you know, I don't know, man. Johnny might have to go. I might have to have a $0 policy.
Hey, man, look. You ain't lying, but
we're gonna do the world. No robots come in. No more robots.
Speak to me, J-Bot.
Let's go with post 2000. This is post 2000, so 2000, yeah. You know, millennial, I guess. Worst comic book movie.
Oh man, I try not to see bad movies.
Sometimes it happens.
Let me think. Worst comic book movie. Oh man. When's Spawn come out? Not before, right? I didn't love Spawn. After 2000, they were kind of stable, right? I mean, there's like some you liked and some you didn't like, but I don't remember being like angry. After 2000, it wasn't like Steel or anything.
look, Steel will hold a special part in the hood's heart. All right, even though it was true,
I get it. Don't let me step on anybody's joy. I can't really think of something that. When did that third X-Men movie come out?
That was
trash.
Yeah.
that one hurt
my feelings.
That third one, man.
That hurt my feelings.
It was all in the back of everybody's heads, and like we.
I like that.
We unplugged. You liked it?
No, I didn't like that.
Yeah, the other one.
I don't mind saying something about that because I don't think anybody who did that thinks it's good either. I think they all know. Yeah, I think that's a safe one. I don't think anyone would get offended. Brett Ratner ain't gonna get mad at me. But I don't know. You know, just it didn't come together. That one did not come together for me.
True.
You know what?
I've never heard anybody say that they love that movie. I've heard people say it's okay. That's the highest praise I've ever heard.
I think I like two so much, and then three just felt like a piece of business to me. But I think they've been pretty stable, man. I think since the first X-Men film, really since the first Blade movie, there's been more consistency. It's just been about like a little bit better here, a little worse there. But I think they've kind of gotten to a decent spot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because prior to that, oh man, I don't know if there were any good superhero other than Batman, obviously, 89.
Hey man, we have Blank Man. Calm down.
That's right, you got that Blank Man. You got that
Meteor Man.
That's a Meteor Man.
My dad took me to go see that.
Everyone's dad took them to go see that. Don't be ashamed. Robert Townsend made an entire career on your dad showing moves.
Let's go X-Men or Teen Titans.
Because X-Men?
Okay. That's a tough one for me because, obviously X-Men are amazing, but that 80s run of Teen Titans? Oh, man. It's like so ahead of its time, to me at least.
Oh yeah, they're both group books, but they're so different. I think X-Men meant a lot to me growing up because you just identified with, being a mutant. And I just locked into that in a way that Teen Titans I enjoyed, but almost enjoyed that the same way I enjoy like Justice League or something. It didn't feel like a collection of freaks, but X-Men felt like a bunch of people making lemonade out of the lemons they were dealt. And I just kind of resonated with that a little bit more. And I had a crush on Storm growing up because she had a mohawk and I was feeling that.
Gotcha.
I feel that.
Thanks to Yukio, who just showed up in Deadpool.
Yeah, right on.
I love little references and stuff like that in any of these movies that come out. I get so hype over like the smallest things. There was a on the side of the taxi that they were driving in Deadpool 2, it says Alpha Flight on it.
Okay, I noticed that too.
So
I got hyped. I was like, they're having fun
over there in that Deadpool camp, man. They look like they are enjoying themselves.
Oh yeah,
Deadpool,
no doubt.
I still have to go. I still got to get out there and go see it. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, yeah, I won't spoil anything. Other than Yu-Gi-Oh, she's just there.
Oh yeah, no, I don't worry about all that. I'm just gonna, well, you know, I Zazie just has a special place in my heart, so I gotta go see her whenever she does anything.
Oh yeah, she's, oh man, after,
she just seems so cool.
After Atlanta, oh, she's cool in this movie too. I'm telling you, she's the smoothest person in this movie. Yeah, you gotta see it.
Yeah, she has so much charisma. It's like, yeah, okay, I'll watch this for sure.
We'll do just a couple more. Yeah. Good one. Let's go favorite hip hop song.
Oh man, that's
kind of, oh man, you gotta change that up.
That's a loaded question. I like these hard ones though. They're hard. You know? I thought the other one was hard, but he answered it like Hannibal Lecter, no question. So I had to go with another one of those kind of hard.
That's like, oh man. It's hard to like nail it down because you listen to something and you just keep listening to it at the moment, but you wouldn't like really clock it as your favorite. I'll tell you what. Black Steel and the Hour of Chaos.
Okay. Cass, you got one? I just want to hear it just in case you got one.
I was gonna alternate that and say like, what's the first hip hop song you fell in love with? Because that's like,
that would probably be Welcome to the Terror Dome.
Okay.
I was a PE kid. I was definitely a PE kid when I was growing up, and that got me like kind of really into hip hop. And then I went through the phase. It took me a while to like get to Jay-Z. Strangely enough, like I liked it, but I didn't really get it. And then I don't know when the switch over happened. At some point, it like just clicked, and I was like, oh, I get why this is so fire. I understand, you know. So most of what I'm listening to right now was like, you know, like I was listening to Drake, Jay-Z, like Pusha T, you know, the stuff people listen to.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, Jay-Z was a little late for me. Well, I heard him, but Nas resonated with me more because it was like you felt more like focused,
grounded.
The problem with Nas is, I listen to Nas and I just want to go sit on the porch and drink.
Yeah.
Depressed.
That's true.
You know? Yeah. Like, you ought to put Nas on at the party and everyone gets, you know, conscious and suddenly like, well, I guess we'll stop drinking after this red cup then. Oppressing my people with my ignorance.
Matter of fact, the biggest podcast's question about the first one you fall in love with, It Ain't Hard to Tell was my first, by Nas. That was the one that I was in love with that song. I was like, this is just so, like, these lyrics are just so raw, man. I'm just vibing with it, man. Like, love it. All right, one more. I will do an easy one. Let's go, what's your favorite green lady? Either She-Hulk or Gamora?
She-Hulk.
Okay. That was quick. Over Gamora, for Gamora.
Yeah.
I got a question. All right. So since you're an 80s baby, all right.
Yeah.
Or 80s kid, I'm sorry. What's your favorite Prince song in the 80s?
When Doves Cry.
When Doves Cry?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
the answer.
That's a good
one.
Yeah, right. For sure.
I think we survived the supersonic question session.
Right on.
that was some good stuff. That, man, like I love those questions. They always generate these like crazy offbeat conversations. But yeah, man, I think that's all we got for right now. We've been here for, did we hit 2 hours?
It's been almost, yeah.
Hour 45, yeah. We usually like to hit a lot about close to 2 hours within that time frame because it's just great to have creators come on. Definitely appreciate you coming to talk to us. Definitely love the positivity, love the inspiration, love the advice, love the just the hump. Even if you didn't give any inspiration to somebody else, saying, you know,
about writing. Your hunger for writing is inspiration enough. Like, just a statement like, oh yeah, I'm not going anywhere. Like, you know, I'm the guy that we're doing this all day. We're going to be here for 12 rounds. You know, mm-hmm. I love that.
That's I'm not going down. It's a long night. You want to fight hell? You buckle up.
Like I told you before, Scares, man, like, take your L even if you got to take your L, man. Like,
I tell people, I'm not saying you can't beat me, but you ain't going to look like you beat me.
Right.
I mean, you know, that's a good.
You won't know who won from the snapshot. Yeah. I promise you that.
Yeah, Brian's going to be, he's that last dude standing up to Thanos.
Oh yeah, I'm not that last fool.
After Captain America.
I'm definitely that last fool.
But yeah.
And the one that he gives the smirk and then he says something cool and then he knocks me off the world.
So what, you snap your fingers, man? Look at you. Your chin is...
I still got a thumb. I'm gonna thumb you.
Oh man.
Yeah, definitely love having you come on. Again, one more time, just so people remember, where can they find you at?
Oh, they can find me on Twitter. It's like the best place to go grab me on social media. It's at Brian with a Y, at Brian Edward Hill. And yeah, just follow me on there and, you know, holler at me about whatever and I'll holler at you back. And all the new announcements and updates and stuff, they usually hit Twitter first. So, you know, get on it and join the fam.
We're a real quick cast, tell people where they can find you at.
You can find me primarily on Twitter these days at Sean Caswell J, or just Sean Caswell. That's my Twitter handle, and yeah, I'm usually tagging along with this fool on Twitter as well. So yeah, you can't miss.
And of course, you can find me at Fourth Wall. That's Ivy Wall, or at Ivy Wall on Twitter. Also at Wakanda Forever, again with an IV instead of the four. You can also email us any questions, comments. If you have any questions or comments for Brian here, you can relay through our email if you don't go to him directly, and I'll try to get it back in contact with them and see if he can answer anything. You can email us at Wakanda Forever at fourthwall.net, which is also you can find the blog at fourthwall.net. Also, doeveencomicbook.com. This will be on doeveencomicbook.com as well, as per usual. And that's all we got. We are out.
Legacy, got it. I sleep in my bed with a goddess. Convene with a heart full of prophets. Flowing from door to the door, I'm a logic. Come from the knowledge and stay for the cast. Think you may actually make it at last. Otherwise, you can just lay in the cast. Mac has to give me the bigger.